the last 9 years as a Buddhist monk in Canada, and the last year and a half of it is Donna has been involved in that, and will be interested to hear my version of the history. And lots of people in this room have been involved in various stages of it as well, being out to visit me in BC, and also have been part of my visits to Ottawa. And I've been going over in my mind how many years have we been coming out here now, and I can't decide. I just don't know. I have to, maybe Anoma can, is this, this is sixth visit? Yeah. Yeah, so that means 5 years? Yeah, 5 years is the sixth. Okay, I thought so. But it's easy to lose track of all these things. So it's very interesting to see the development here. And so I'll make a formal beginning. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Well, this is kind of a nice, easy Dhamma talk for me, just recounting this episode, but I've never really done this as a formal talk, and I hope that it comes out as a balance of autobiography, if you can use that word in a Buddhist context, non-autobiography, anatta-biography. There you go, I think I just thought of a new title for a book, Anatta-biography of Ajahn Sona. And also just kind of part of history, because it is interesting to be at the very beginning of the arrival of the Dhamma and the Theravada forest tradition in North America, a whole huge continent with, you know, the probably 10 times the population of the earth at the time of the Buddha in it, and just now after over 2500 years to be arriving with the full formal tradition and being right at the beginning. So a lot of your names are going to be down in the history books as the first, you know, people to introduce it, to sustain it, and the various dramatic, tragic, and comedic stories that go along with that. We are at the beginning. It is just like the first disciples of the Buddha in India, and history repeats itself as it moves to new lands and adaptations take place. But I thought you got to start somewhere with Buddhist history, because in general it's beginningless, so you just have to choose an arbitrary time. So I thought I'd start from just after, or begin at the end of my time in Thailand. I had been in Thailand for 3.5 years before heading out on an airplane back to Canada, and hadn't been home to Canada for about 6 years. And I recall, I think, the last person who asked me, I recall telling them that I had no intention of leaving Thailand. Next thing I knew, I was on a plane to Canada. And I'd been telling people that for 3.5 years. I was very contented and happy to stay there the rest of my life. I said, I have no intentions of leaving. But interesting, of course, this is one of the three characteristics of the universe, that it is impermanent. But another way of putting impermanent, it is uncertain. It is not always easy to know what's going to happen and where you're going to be. So I was always careful to phrase that as, I have no intention of leaving. That's something you can know now. You can all you can know really is your intention, and all you can report is your intention now. So if you want to be very careful with your speech, when people ask you about the future, just say, I have no intention of such and such. You're safe that way. My mind was far away from actually returning to Kanakoi, happy in monks' paradise over in Thailand with thousands of monks and thousands of monasteries. Very wonderful training center, the International Forest Monastery. The abbot of which, and my teacher at the time, was a Canadian that so many of you have met, Ajahn Pasanal. And he, at that time, had been abbot there for about eight or nine years, which is fairly a burdensome task, an onerous task. There's between 10 and 20 monks there all the time, so it's a fairly demanding task. And he had decided to take 1 year's sort of retreat in England. So, and I had just finished my fifth rains. Monks count their years in the robes as rains. After the rainy season, you have one more rains on your belt. And when you get to your fifth rain, if you are competent, you are given independence. Before that time, you have to stay with your teacher. You cannot live apart from the community. You cannot live apart from a monk of more than 10 years in the robes, a competent monk teacher, for the duration of the rainy season. So you can go out for periods of time and meditate on your own, but you have to be back for that period of time and must spend it with a teacher in a monastery. And that goes on for 5 years as your monk. And at the end of that, if you're judged to be competent, you can now take up independence and go off and live on your own or with other monks, always within the context of the rules of discipline for the monk and what's appropriate to the monk's lifestyle. So I just reached that time. I just finished the rains with Ajahn Pasanal. He was going off to England. And at the time, a letter arrived from an old friend of mine in Canada named Kirti Senaratne, a Sri Lankan living in Canada, actually Canadian now, I guess. And he had met me when I was a lay hermit. Before I was a monk, I was up to this kind of business before as well. Hidden far in the mountains, in the coastal mountains of Vancouver for a number of years as a lay hermit, practicing in a strange coincidence or synchronicity or a piece of karma. Kirti Manish, who is very interested in Dhamma practice himself, and blundered upon me out in this, 3 hours outside of the city in the forest, and was quite astonished to find a solid practitioner of Buddhist meditation devoting himself in this hermitage to mainstream Theravada forest practice. And it set something off for him at the time. Very interesting how these repercussions go around the world. He had done some practice, but most of the Sri Lankan community, when they were in Canada, they were busy getting jobs and doing things, and they really hadn't been all that preoccupied with their very own religion, which they'd grown up with. And he thought, they had no Buddhist monastery at all in Vancouver. No Buddhist monks, just the occasional visiting monk who would come through, the legendary Bhante Piyadasi, who had, as on his, I think his 14th trip around the world in 28 years, to dropping in everywhere, he would come through occasionally. But that, aside from that, was very little seen. There's a little bit of a cultural event, maybe a celebration of the Buddha's birthday, but just very little happening in the Asian communities, but also the Thai community, the Burmese community, the Lao community, nothing. And so it kind of shocked him and sobered him up a little bit that I was spending all my time doing that. I found it so incredibly valuable that I'd come across this amazing teaching. I thought it was worthwhile just quitting everything and going off and doing it. So this was a seed that got sown quite apart from my intention. And it was to come back in a little flower 6 years later, because it stayed on his mind, and eventually he got around. Well, I went off to ordain in West Virginia and to practice also in Thailand over a period of the next 6 years. He got it together with the community and started to do some meditations and bring in more monks, and then finally they decided to actually commit themselves to making a monastery there and inviting permanently some monks. And at the inaugural speech of it, his opening speech, which he sent me in a letter, was that he'd met this hermit, a Canadian hermit monk, or monk hermit or something, a lay hermit, in the woods a number of years back, and it had been on his mind that the Sri Lankan community wasn't doing much about their own religion, and here other people were treating it as with great respect and enormous energy. So this fellow had inspired him to do something about it. So that happened to me. So he sent me this letter and a picture of the new monastery, which was happened to be in one of the suburbs of Surrey. And I had been back for 6 years, and there was an offer to come and visit. So I had my five reins. Ajahn Pasno was going away. I thought, I could just go back. I had no vision of what would happen, but it would be a little bit of a visit. I hadn't seen my parents for 6 or 7 years, and they live in Vancouver. So I told Ajahn Pasno, now, my particular order of monks, which is perhaps the largest Theravada forest tradition around the world in the West, we're quite strict with our Vinaya or monk's discipline, so none of us have any money. We don't carry money, we don't hold money. And in the monasteries we live in, there is no individual, reserve fund for any individual monk. It's any donations made to the monastery go into a central fund. And it's not designated for any individual monk, so we have no resources at all. If you want to go somewhere, you start walking. Anyway, it so happened that they sent monks to Bangkok once a month to give a talk, Western monks, at the request of the World Fellowship of Buddhists, to give talks in English in Bangkok. It's a beautiful center, and it is a World Fellowship of Buddhists. And I had been doing this for a few occasions, so it tied in with a ticket from Thailand to Canada. So I arrived in Bangkok, went to the World Fellowship of Buddhists, and then I was standing on the street, and I was supposed to stay with some lay people in Bangkok, and a van pulled up full of Thais. Now, there are thousands of monks everywhere in Thailand, and they're highly respected, and it's part of the society, but there's not too many Western monks, and they were particularly interested in this. He stopped right away, went over and asked me where I was going. So I said that I was intending to go to this layperson's house. Well, they were going to take me there. Well, I got in the van with them, and it was a very nice 8 or 10 passenger van, and they drove off, but they wanted to take me first to to see their business. And I was just, you gotta be in Asia. This is normal. So they took me to their factory. I thought it would be like a clothing store, a little store or something, that where they sold clothes or something. And I was gonna bless it and then get out of there. So it turned out to be something called the Nice Apparel Company, and it was big, actually. I didn't know how big, but they took me in, and there was this, apparently it looked to me like they had about 30 workers there, and they took me into the boardroom, and the boardroom was about half the size of this hall, with silk Chinese carpets on and mahogany tables and so forth. And then they brought out a little cup of green tea and made me sit down in the chairman's leather chair or whatever it was, and then wanted to introduce me to some of their workers, so they brought in two or three people, and they bowed. I said my grand total of three words in Thai to them, and somebody translated, spoke, etc. Went on for about 5 minutes, and then they left, and the next group came in. Another three, four people, they bowed, said a little exchange, they left. And finally, this kept going on for about an hour, and I thought I only saw about 30 people out there. You know. Anyway, that was just the office staff. There were 1,500 workers in this place. I got introduced to all of them. 1,500 people in groups of twos and threes and fours. There was fives and twos and ones and threes and fours and fives. And this went on like all afternoon. So at the end of it all, they wanted to take me to the place, which I was ready to go by that time. They also offered me an envelope, and that in Thailand is very common. You're always offering things, and in the cities, in the country where the forest monastery is established, what you offer the monk is food, but you don't offer money to the monk. But in the cities, it's very common. Monks often receive money, so they offer money to the monks. So our tradition is very strict. We don't accept the money. So they wanted to offer this envelope with a donation, and I said, "Well, I don't accept money. Well, what will we do?" Well, I was thinking, now what will they do? What you could do is you will give it to the chauffeur, who's going to take me back to this layperson's house. And it happened to be a very wealthy, very strangely, the wealthiest families in Bangkok support the most austere forest tradition. So when you do stay in there, it's like at an estate, you know, and they have a separate house built for monks and servants and all this kind of stuff. So I said, well, your chauffeur will give it to the gardener at there. He will keep it and then give it to the lady of the house, and then she will know what to do with it. So I didn't even look at it. So this envelope had passed around. I stayed overnight. The lady of the house came out the next day, and she said, "The gardener came up and gave me this. There's a check for $500 US here. That $500 US in Thailand is a fortune. You know, it's just a huge amount of money." So I didn't know what to do with it. But she had connections all over the world. So she's going to wire it to California. California's going to wire it to Vancouver. Somebody in Vancouver is going to tell my mother, and etc. So it got to a steward. Now, a steward is allowed to accept money for you, but you can't just take the money and go out and buy something. The steward, you can say what you need. So I have need of a pair of shoes or something. The steward, if they take the hint, will go out and get you the pair of shoes. I figured my mother would take the hint, so I didn't know anybody else. I mean, I haven't been back there for 6 or 7 years. Who else? I'm thinking, who do I know? Oh yeah, my mother. So my mother became the steward. I arrived was taken to the Sri Lankan Vihara. There was already a Sri Lankan monk there. There was a Burmese monk and a Sri Lankan monk. And so it was a nice little trio, Canadian monk, Burmese monk, Sri Lankan monk. And all of us had different congregations. So the Burmese didn't talk to the Sri Lankan monk, and they were all different, and they only come to see the Burmese monk. The Sri Lankans would only come to see the... But everybody would come to see me, curiosity. So, and plus the Canadians who weren't relating to the... So it was a very interesting situation. But also... Again, the Vinaya, our Vinaya standard are very strict, and I was absolutely determined to keep the Vinaya when I came here. So one thing is, you're not to accept food that is offered outside of a period between dawn and noon. But in these suburban monasteries, quite often people do bring food to the monks, but they bring it the night before and then offer it, and the monk just takes it out of the fridge and heats it up the next day and goes ahead. But it is not the way it is done. So I made it clear, I don't care what, I won't you know, I won't accept the food. If it's not offered, I can't, I'm not going to make a problem for you, but I just won't, it won't work that way. So this was Kirti I'm talking to, the fellow who established it. He said, oh, what will we do? Because that's, you know, people are working and it's difficult. So, oh yes, there's an old fellow named Punya, actually, who lives about a mile from here, and he's retired, and he's at home, and he'd love to, if they brought it to his house, you could go there. So I ended up doing alms round in Surrey every morning. I would walk down in my sandals in January. I arrived January the 17th in the snow and in my sandals. I was a little bit attached to that idea, so it was a long time before I accepted shoes. You know, you learn over time, eh? So I would walk every morning on alms round through Surrey, down the streets and to Punya's house where he would offer. We had a great relationship. He's still there, and that because of Punya, I'm here. You know, if I couldn't get food, I just would have gone home. I would have gone back. You know, if I couldn't live within the context of Vinaya, it's either it works with Vinaya or I go back to Thailand. So fortunately, were people willing to stretch a little bit and accept that. And so it began. It was a very, it was a touching time. I was a little bit shell-shocked from coming out right out of the forest monasteries of Thailand and not very adaptive and had just been away a long time. So it was a little strange. And the people who were showing up, it was a lot of feeling around, what do I do with these people, and how do I talk to them, etc. But eventually, you know, it evolved, and there was also another factor in the formula. I had made arrangements with a German monk who had been in Thailand for 7 years to come and join me in this monastery. Neither of us had any notion about staying or how long this would, but he was also passing through. So he arrived, so we had a German monk, a Burmese monk, a Sri Lankan monk, a Canadian monk. Very, very different. All of the crowds coming and going. So, but it turned out we were quite popular. So a lot of people were showing up to the monastery, but we had been, now we're trapped in the suburbs of Vancouver, in a suburban house in the middle of winter with nothing but sandals. And we're both committed to the forest, so it was a bit difficult to get through. But he said to me about the beginning of April, as I arrived in January, say, could we maybe get out and look at the forest around here or something? I said, well, I don't know what for. We have no reason. We do. All you have is this $500. What use is that going to be? Oh, we had paid, I think, $150 of it for his health insurance. So I think we had $350 US left. But he said, hey, what about that hermit shack you lived in? I'd love to go see that. So I said, well, I wonder if it's still standing even. So we arranged somebody to take us up there and look at it. So we drove off. It was beautiful to get out of town. We arrived at this old shack, and it was a real shack. And looked in there, and it was quite an impressive place, a fantastic area of nature. And there was another old shack there with all the windows broken out. It hadn't been lived in for 10 years, rats and rain coming through the roof. And we went over there and looked, and he said, with a slight German accent, fabulous. This is fabulous. I wonder if we can still rent this. I said, well, you know, I don't know if the old man, these shacks shouldn't have been rented. They weren't fit for human habitation, but, you know, I did use them as a hermit, and they were $50 a month then, overpriced at $50 a month. So I got taken out for tea today, and it was almost that much for the tea. It was a strange kind of, anyway. We went to see if this old man was still alive, which he was. He was in his 80s. And these two Buddhist monks walk in and talk to him. And ask him if that shack is, oh, are you sure? I'll rent it to you. $50. So, wow, we were... So he was ecstatic. I thought, well, I don't know whether we can fix this place up. Okay, we don't have any funds or anything. All the windows are kicked out, and it's just been, I don't know whether it'll even, it might fall over. So he was, he left the next, we took him back, and then he got a hold of somebody to be a steward. Now, this is the problem. Monks can't cook for themselves, can't store food, etc. We need a steward to go with us. And this is a vital part of our monastic structure now. So it's not just a matter of dropping food off. You're way off in the middle of the bush. There's no phone there. There's not even any running water. It's just, there's an outhouse, but it has no building around it. It's just a thing outside. And no power, no nothing. So you don't get much for $50. So. But we do need somebody to offer the food. Now, there's no refrigeration, no stove, no nothing to cook on. Anyway, that didn't daunt us, because in the Thai tradition, we've been living very rough and living in caves and out under trees and so forth, and that's no problem. So we found somebody to do this. Now, what kind of person do you think we found to move instantly up into the bush, to live under the table in this place? Well, interesting characters. Now, there's been a whole cast of characters who have become our stewards. I want to preserve right speech here, but I will tell you a saying by Socrates. There are three kinds who live outside of society: the criminal, the insane, and the wise. Now, give me the benefit of the doubt that I was amongst the wise. But it's a strange phenomenon that sometimes the three find themselves living together. So, the three of us were there. And we had $300 to live on for the rest of our lives. My parents contributed a two-burner Coleman propane cooking stove from somewhere around 1971, if I recall, and one burner worked. Somebody then gave a bag, the Thais had discovered us by this time, and they gave us a bag of rice. So we had a bag of rice, two-burner stove, one worked, and $300 to live for the rest of her life. It was a U.S. dollar, so. So we started living there. It was cold. It was just in April, and the stove, there was a stove, but the pipe had rotted right off because of the rain and so forth, so it was useless. We had no heat source, but we didn't have any wood anyway, so it was just fine. We had no way of getting wood. So we settled in there, but we were just so happy to be out there. And again, we had no idea that this would, how long this would last, but we knew we could probably last a month or two, and it doesn't matter who came or what, we would, live on this bag of rice. We also made a determination. The German monk happened to be sort of especially notorious for enjoying extreme austerities. A bit famous around the monastery I was at. So in one way he was good to put up with this, but also sometimes I doubted his judgment. And so his idea was that we would not ever buy food. We would only rely on what was given to us. So, I mean, there's nobody around there. It's like... So it's like rice day after day, and then but somebody did show up. Some Thais showed up, some Sri Lankans showed up, and they left us with some cabbages and this and that. But then we had no refrigeration. We ended up storing it. Of course, I had experience as a hermit, and I had the same condition. So I had found some plywood and made a box in the river. Now a river ran past, beautiful glacial river of pure, clear water. But we had no way of getting building materials or anything like that. We had a few things. And But there was an old barn, a dilapidated barn on the property, full of pack rats and old discarded beds and all kinds of stuff. And this became what we called home hardware. We went over there. I ransacked this place for rotten pieces of plywood. I built this thing, propped it up with boulders, put it in the river, and we put our vegetables in there to keep them. I think that thing must have washed away about 3 or 4 times. The river would come up, you go out for your food, gone. Down the river. A few times bears came and did the work for the river. Destroyed it, took everything. So it was an interesting ongoing process. But it somehow we survived in that people heard about us. We had no sign. It was very interesting. How would people even find the turnoff when they describe? The German monk ended up climbing a hydro tower. You know those things with the bar, you know, the high things with the high tension lines? And he got an old yellow blanket out of home hardware. Baby blanket, I don't know why, but it was yellow at least. The symbol of the. And he climbed up. I turned around, there he's 3/4 of the way up this. I said, "What are you doing up there?" "I'm making a sign." So he tied the baby blanket around this structure halfway. Now that was the sign. You know, when you saw the baby blanket, turn. This was a very. A little comedic element to it. This place was called Number 10 Downing Street. It had been built at a log cabin in the late 1890s. And then an old man, after the First World War, a fellow had bicycled out from Saskatchewan, a First World War vet, on the railroad tracks, because there were no roads into there. He bicycled out on the railroad tracks, got off his bicycle there and proceeded to stay there until 1980. And he, the census taker, and somebody was appointed as the census, that the fellow who lived in there was appointed the census taker for the valley. And that's like a total of 7 people living in the valley who all knew each other. This guy, it went to his head. He was extremely important, so he would go around and knock on, you know, this neighbor's door of the news for 10 years. "I'm taking the census, sir. How many inhabitants of this house?" "What are you talking about, John? You were just here last night." "Never mind, sir. I'm representing the British, the Queen." And so they thought this was funny. Anyway, somebody came over and painted on his door when he was asleep, Number 10 Downing Street. He came out in the morning, he turned around, he saw this painted on his door, and he liked it. He became like the Prime Minister of the Valley. And it stayed that way, and he was a bit of a folk artist, so he made a whole shrine around Number 10 Downing Street, and it was also, he had made cannons he had experienced in the First World War out of stovepipes. And the flag, the Union Jack was flying, and all of the battles from the First World War, and the 54th Patricia Infantry, which was in all beautifully painted, and it was quite a spectacle. It's still beside the tracks, and the BC Rail runs past there, and it's still a very kind of a tourist thing. People look out the window. But that was mixed in with that, and it was all crumbling. They had long ago left it, and it was all dilapidated. And we were but 2 Buddhist monks living amongst there. So it was a nice thing for the rail. The engineers got to know us. They'd pass that every day, and they'd, on the radio, they'd say, "Now this is where there's some Buddhist monks living in there at Number 10 Downing Street." So they'd be, the engineer of the train was married to a Thai woman, and he would why. The German monk didn't like any kind of interaction, but he couldn't help himself. When the engineer train why to him, he had to wave back. So it was a strange little place, and people, eccentrics in the valley, discovered us, and also just ordinary people discovered us. Again, we had no phone, no electricity, no nothing but people. And the shack was about 20 feet by 14, and we found a tool shed. Well, it was an old tool shed by the railroad tracks. We fixed it up for the German monk to live in. It was a really dilapidated little place, and it had no heat, and we couldn't put heat in. It was too small. So he lived over near the railroad tracks, and about 6 freight trains a day would go by there, and it would just like shake the whole place. It would just shake. It really, these days, they wouldn't let you put anything like that close to the railroad. One night, one of the trains had something wrong with its wheel, and went by at 2 o'clock in the morning. He was in a sort of dreaming, and he dreamed that the train had gone off the track and was about to wipe out his cabin. This is in the middle of winter. He jumped up in his undies and ran out into the snow, ran 50 feet away, and watched the train go by, standing there, and then walked back. He told me about it the next day. But so this was called number 10 Downing. This was also became Birkin, because we decided after about a year, we're lasting, it keeps going, that we would make a charitable society to support the monastery, so that if people gave donations, they could get a tax receipt, and then we could make it official. So the title we gave to them was Buddhist Forest Monastery, but that wasn't specific enough, so they asked us to give us more a location. So the place, the area was called Birkin, so we picked that, and that's how we became Birkin Forest Monastery. We've kept it ever since, because once you start with a name, it's hard to stop. Where we are now, there's no birch. Birkin means birch. So we've actually planted a birch. In fact, we have 600 birches coming that we're going to plant in order to make it a birch monastery. So we have to kind of follow the name. But anyway, we survived there. We ended up being there for 3.5 years. After we went through various steward crises, and we came to the point where it was unlikely to get a steward, and we were hadn't eaten for a few days. So the German monk, against my advice, against my very clear advice, decided to disrobe and become a novice, because a novice can offer food. He can store food and offer food, and he can cook food. So he became a novice. It was a great kind of sacrifice. Not that I approved of it, but so for the next 6 or 8 months, wearing novice robes, he became a novice. After he'd been in the robes for 8 years by this time, and he offered the food. You remember that he was the sort of foremost in ascetic kind of thing. It was quite a challenge. The only dish he really knew how to make were French fries. A whole meal of French fries. Many meals of French fries. Nothing but French fries. But eventually, we had the opportunity to get another steward, and we got him back in the ropes, so he had full ordination. Not too long after that, I was told that we were starting, there was a new monastery purchased in Canada, or given in Canada, to Ajahn Pasno, and it was outside of Thunder Bay. And the abbot there, which some of you met, Punadamo, didn't have 5 reins. He was in his 5th reign. And so he needed another senior monk to stay with him in order to legitimize that. So I went to Thunder Bay for 6 months, left the German monk at number 10 Downing Street, Birkin Monastery, and to have many colorful adventures. And I went to Thunder Bay to have many colorful adventures. We started at the Arrow River community, and that's still going. And that was a very enjoyable exercise. Punadamo had been in Thailand as well for 5 years, or probably 6 years. And that was a well-established, it was quite luxurious compared to the shack that I had come from. And it's not that luxurious, it's just, it has no power, there's outhouses, but it was quite nice by the standards I was used to. So I spent 6 months there. We got it organized, we built another building for monks to stay in, etc. And then I returned to Birkin Monastery. The German monk had decided to go to Asia, to Burma, and he's still there at a famous monk's monastery called Pa Ok Sayadaw's Monastery, practicing there. So I was left just another steward to myself for the winter, and we continued, but the place was put up for sale. So we'd been there. By the time I actually left there, we were there for 3.5 years, and I had spent about 3 years as a hermit there, so I must have spent almost 7 years in that area. And I think it wasn't much impulse to really leave, but it was sold out from underneath us, and we had to find a new place. And in the meantime, I think about $20,000 had been donated to the steward, or to the society. We had $20,000 to, and this time I thought, if we don't buy a monastery, I will go back to Thailand. Because we couldn't fix this shack up. And I thought, if you're going to have a monastery, you must have some control over the property and be able to make it suitable for a monastery. So I naively thought, you know, you could go out and buy clear title land for $20,000 and build a monastery. Well, this turned out to be a little bit of a rather out of touch with reality, and we began to look. But as we began to look, the search went on for 6 months, and as more people got interested in it, they donated to it. And so we did. We ended up. One of the things I learned was that if you draw a circle around Vancouver every hour out, that $20,000 will buy you some what was called moose pasture in the middle of nowhere, about 8 hours out of Vancouver, which we indeed did look. I remember walking 5 miles in with the real estate lady in her cowboy boots in the snow to see this land, which was what they call, I call it a swamp, they call it moose pasture. And that's where our search began, and that was what we could, at that time, afford. But as every month that went by, we moved one circle closer to Vancouver, and eventually we moved to the third circle out, 3 hours out. And we finally found a place that was just perfect. And I was being assisted by this time by a very helpful layman who some of you know, Dr. Miguel Romero, who had been formerly here in Ottawa. And also his wife at the time, Dr. Elizabeth Lund, both PhDs in chemistry, both teaching and working at the UBC. Very helpful. And they were helping me look for this land. Very difficult. I had no phone or anything, so I couldn't a real estate search. It was a very strange bit of business. But as we looked, more funds came in, and finally found a place. And Miguel Romero and I took a 35 millimeter camera and one of those throwaway Polaroid sort of landscape photos, you know, throwaway camera. It had one shot left in it. So we went to this place, the perfect place, a reasonable thing we could perhaps buy it. Took photos of the whole place and the 35 millimeter. And the last photo, we took a view across the valley to the other side just to show people the view. Went back to our group, our committee, and we wanted to get the film developed to make an offer on this place, every shot came out black. Not a single picture came out except for this throwaway panorama, which was across the valley. Strange. So we phoned up the realtor, and usually properties in the country, they take 2 or 3 years to sell. So we were quite confident, especially in this area, that there was no problem, we could get it for a good price. We made an offer. The real estate salesman said, oh, it's bought. Somebody bought it for full price. We looked at this picture, the panorama of a place across the road. We said, take the offer and put it on that place. So we ended up there. That was the monastery. And it turned out to be a much better monastery. The place we were looking at turned out to be in the shadow by about 2 in the afternoon. And it had a lot of land, but the house was only half the size. This one was, in the end, this one, the house was larger. The land was smaller, but it was in the sunshine. It turned out to be the ideal place. So I learned a lot about the non-linear aspects of looking for monasteries. That monastery, and many people in the room have been there, was outside of Princeton, BC, and it was just, when we first arrived there, it was just overwhelming. Flush toilets inside, and a phone. There was even electricity. It was about 18 acres, and we actually owned it. And it was a kind of a manufactured house on the basement. It seemed enormous. It was just enormous to me, because I'd been living in this little shack. Has all kinds of possibilities. And Miguel Romero wanted to go into the robes. And, I skipped a little part of the story. Elizabeth Lund, Dr. Elizabeth Lund, his wife, had become a nun before him. And she had actually, in the Shack Monastery, she bought a trailer, moved it up there, and become a nun. We made her a nun. She, not too long after that, went to Thailand and stayed on as a nun for 5 years. He also decided to ordain. So he became the first, my first monastic disciple. And he took a novice ordination on October the 8th, which is the day of our possession date of this new place, and also the opening. So we had about 50 people from the Sri Lankan Thai community to open it, and a novice ordination done by Ajahn Pasno. And so there we were, a novice and a monk and a steward, another interesting character. And in our own, the first real forest monastery in Western Canada that we actually owned. We continued on there, and it was just a series of growth. The first year we had 150 people come and stay with us. We were obviously going to outgrow it. It was a lovely place, but it was a little bit too close to people and so forth. Not the ideal place. But I thought perhaps we'd be there for 10 years before we could move on to the final monastery. And we were running out of space and everything. And then out of the blue, a phone call came and somebody donated $150,000 to us. And I thought, well, we can pay off the mortgage and all this stuff. Maybe now time to look for the next monastery. And then following that, another donation, $300,000. Another $300,000. So we were definitely moving on. We sort of jumped 10 years ahead. And so we went on the next search. And that was the moment we came out of our winter retreat. We were scrambling around looking for places, but looking for a sort of final place. And again, we had notions about what it should be. Bare land. We thought we'd build the place from scratch. That turned out to be not the way it worked out at the same time. In a way, we had our sights set on a final monastery. We're not moving from this one, and it had to be large enough to accommodate the continuing growth, etc. So every time you set your limit, you kind of raise your expectations as well. So it came down to near the wire of purchasing. We did find this place that we are presently at, and it was huge, enormous kind of structure on it, and 80 acres, and just perfect solitude, ideal in many ways. But it took all of our money. It took $450,000, and it wasn't finished, and it would require quite a bit of financing to finish, at least $200,000 to just get it barely finished. And I had to leave to go conduct some retreats in Ottawa and in Calgary, so I was phoning back to the monastery while this final negotiations were going on. We actually made an offer, and it was the fellow who owned it was in Thailand. It was going back through a realtor this way and that way, and we're just right on the edge of it. And it looked like we couldn't buy it because we really needed about $100,000 just to barely squeak in there. And I was on the phone in Calgary, and I was just a retreat had finished, and I was taken to a layperson's house to stay overnight, and I'd never met this man before. He wasn't at my retreat. I've never met him before. I asked to use his phone. The phone conversation was, I think we just can't do it because the financing just isn't there. So I hung up. He said, I just happened to overhear the conversation. I'd be happy to give you $100,000. It'd be my honor. And I said, sure. And he said, I'm all going to phone my banker right now and transfer it into your account. And so I phoned the bank and said, okay, go ahead. Story's changed in the last minute or so. Somebody just gave us $100,000. So it was just like that. So it was a go. And so we actually purchased it, and then we had two monasteries. Now, there's a few little tangles. We had to sell the monastery we were in. And we really had to sell it in order to really be able to do the proper financing. We couldn't keep the both of them going and everything. And we were a little still tangled up. Now, it is not easy to be a monk in the middle of real estate deals. We're just... we can't even accept a sandwich before dawn. I mean, it's just, it is not the position you want to be in, trying to negotiate real estate and deal with all this bureaucracy and everything as a monk. It's very difficult. So we had to, but we did have a lot of talent start to be around the monastery. It wasn't just us. It was Venerable Tita Puño, who was now a fully ordained monk, of course, very smart, very able to handle things, and we had some good stewards now. It wasn't just the criminal, the insane, and the wise. It was more than the criminal and the insane. There was some wise stewards around as well, and so they helped us, have brought up some their capacities to deal with the world, which I haven't, I really haven't been dealing with the world for a long time, so I'm not the best person to do these things. Donna actually was one of our prime negotiators in this matter, who she was given the task of selling the monastery. She said, you sell the monastery for us. Go ahead. So that was good, very fortunate. And we had to go off. We had now two monasteries. We had to start finishing and negotiating with building contractors, etc., to undertake our new monastery. In the meantime, we had to function and continue our meditation practice and so forth. And so again, we came up against the wire with funding, and so we had to get a loan. We had to get another $100,000 loan. So it was, and the banks weren't, for some reason, they don't like us, the banks. When we ask, they ask, "How? What's your income?" We say, "Well, people just give us stuff." You know, what do? You run any business? No, I just people just give us stuff. You know, whenever is there any more to it than that? No. We eventually turned to the Bank of Donna. So one of our stewards provided us with the funding to go by and until we could bridge this difficult time. So it's been a story of people, you know, when the need is there, people step in. And it's being part of the Buddhist world. It's just really amazing to watch this process. And I learned to trust that, to the way it works. And this is the history of Buddhism in Canada. There's some agency there that is acting and working and providing the sustenance to keep going. The whole idea of a monastery and living without any money and just waiting for people to give you food just sounds crazy, doesn't it? You know, it's extraordinarily idealistic, almost outrageously idealistic, and especially sort of keeping up with old rules that were made 2,500 years ago. But strangely enough, it works. The Buddha wasn't—he was quite smart. You wouldn't think the structure that he came up with. You can imagine the Buddha saying, or if you didn't know it was the Buddha and he's sitting in a room with him, he said, "I got an idea. Men and women will just give up their families, all food and everything. They just go off into the woods to meditate all day and seek enlightenment." And then you say, like, "Yeah, but how do they live?" "Well, people will just give them food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. And but they're not allowed to ask for it, and they won't eat after. They only eat at certain times. They won't be able to cook for themselves, etc." Like, yeah, sounds like, you know, absolutely the most impractical thing you ever heard of in your life. But it is the longest, most stable corporation on the face of the earth, the largest as well. The monastic sangha has lasted 25 centuries, flourishing and affecting a substantial portion of the population of the earth, and still going and still working, even in this places like Canada, with those conditions being kept intact. In fact, the closer you stay with these ideals, the more it inspires idealistic thinking, and it brings out we all are idealists. And we do respond and are inspired by high ideals, not by, you know, boring practicalities, but the best in humans come out. And so, again and again, I saw this happening, that the best in humans comes out to support the best in humans. And to the higher you strive, it's really in people to respond to that. So, we ended up neatly selling the old monastery and moving on and having enough funds and completing by an enormous sort of process of labor. We did a lot of the labor ourselves. People stepped forward to join the community. Two of our people are, one was a professor of religious studies at the University of Calgary. Has dropped out to become a monastic applicant in the monastery. Done enormous kinds of, lots of, he's our woodcutter, our sign designer, our carpentry, fine detailing expert. Also very skilled in putting insulation into walls. And we have a very successful businessman at his own company selling tires. He's also another monastic applicant. He's the best bobcat driver in the monastery. And we have, so Venerable Tita Punio is with us still. We have a nun, and we have three applicants to become monks. There are two monks there, so there's a total of six monastics. And we have three full-time stewards as well. And the place is very large, beautiful, in the middle of nowhere, very peaceful, ideal, really, quite spectacular, and many, many people coming from, not only from around BC, but even from the United States, from around the world, actually, coming to virtually ideal conditions to practice. And so we see an amazing... I had no idea, stepping onto that plane, coming over here, that any of this would appear. And I had no plan that such a thing would happen. I was coming back to visit my parents for a few weeks and see what happens. And here I am. And then January 17th, it'll be 10 years. And in that time, other things happened. One day, a woman named Anoma, I think it was Anoma, somehow got a hold of me. We're still at the shack, and maybe they phoned the neighbor who had a phone, the nearest neighbor who had a radio phone. Somehow I got a message, and it was something about Ottawa. Ottawa. So there was an invitation to come out to Ottawa. I don't even know how she knew about me, maybe through the Sri Lankan community. So I thought, okay, let's go to Ottawa. So that was 5 years back, and every year since that time I've been coming up. Of course, the community and the people I know are growing, and many of the people from Ottawa have been out to our monasteries, seen this process. So it's becoming a really interesting tale of the bringing of a religion to a faraway country, 25 centuries after the first Buddhist missionary started wandering out, and the same kind of stories recurring again and again, just very similar. Just throw in a few computers and a car or two, and you've got the same stories happening as well. So, and now as well, Calgary and Edmonton have groups, Vancouver, of course, and Seattle. So are sort of regular satellites of the monastery, regular connections to the monastery. So it's been a very kind of an amazing... It just makes you understand, become more confident in the idea of karma, you know. It's an outlandish, really an outlandish kind of story that this kind of structure could have worked. But it has in the most amazing ways. And so... if you're curious about any of these places, I welcome you to come out to BC and visit. The old shack apparently is still standing somewhere. I've been looking for photos of it, but nobody seemed to have ever done anybody to take a photo of the place, because it was such a terrible old shack. Why would you want to? But now it's a kind of piece of history, so we're trying to find some old photos of the place. Second one was well photographed. In fact, a professional photographer came out and took some photos of it, and beautiful photos, and volunteered to make us 5,000 postcards of the place. The only thing was that it took him 2 years to do it, and we got the postcards just as we were moving to the next monastery. 5,000 postcards of the old monastery, which is now just a house, you know. It was a great way of starting fires. It's an interesting, been an interesting process. But I'll leave that for your reflection. This is a different kind of Dhamma talk. This is just this is what goes on, you know, underneath all this Dhamma. There's this huge element of faith and support. Human generosity, human cooperation in the most idealistic of endeavors, and also just enormous energy and labor and patient endurance on the parts of the monastics and the people who support us, and the participation of an amazing spectrum of individuals. Some of the most beautiful acts of generosity and endurance have come out of people who would never have produced that any of those attributes. And when they encounter Dhamma, this most amazing, people just raid out of prison, raid out of psychiatric wards, shine out. They respond in strange ways, in amazing ways to light. And it's a profoundly beautiful relationship with all beings as well. Not only just the spectrum of humans, but also even of animals. Our monastery is a sanctuary for all beings. Even insects. Is a place, a highly idealistic place, where you can be sure you're not going to be harmed. It's in this world. Well, of course, I gave a talk about September 11th, and what I was doing on September 11th was building a monastery, which is, if anything is the opposite of blowing up the World Trade Center, it's building a monastery. The opposite of blowing up the World Trade Center is not building the World Trade Center. The roots of blowing up the World Trade Center are in the basement of the World Trade Center. It is not founded on peace, cooperation, and relinquishment, and generosity. It is founded on ambition. And so, if one wants to do the opposite of what's going on in the world these days, there's no better endeavor than a place where you're relinquishing those kind of attributes and energies that end up in conflict and in confusion and rejection, cruelty, etc. But the opposite for the monastery, where one is cultivating, and sometimes not easily cultivating, tolerance, patience, peace, kindness, vision. I saw my first glimpse today. I was taken to the Parliament buildings. I saw the Prime Minister, the back of his head, anyway. I wanted to say something, but I'm afraid he was gone. So leave that tale of monastery and 9 years in Canada as a Buddhist monk. There were thousands of, I could fill thousands of pages with just, there's so many, there's many touching things, there's many funny things, there's many sad things, just a huge spectrum. It's what in the end I have to say has been, the only word for it is a rich experience. Okay, well, we'll leave that for tonight, and unless, of course, anybody has any questions or any additional comments or anything along those lines. Yes, somebody back there. Yes.
I was wondering, in the presidential term, I didn't find that our so-called community is a way of justifying it.
Yes, I would just repeat that question in case anybody didn't hear that. This is referring back to the talk I gave on Monday, and was really talking about one of the central elements of Buddhist vision, and that is about identity. And the function of identity is to do with objectifying ourselves, objective view of ourselves. You know, the Buddha isn't asking you to give up the useful, convenient aspects of identity. In other words, well, there's a subject self and an object self. And just at a practical level, there are such things. At a practical level, we also talk about the Ottawa River. But we don't really think that there's any thing called the Ottawa River. There is water flowing down in a general area out there? I mean, if the Ottawa River floods its banks, where is the Ottawa River, and where do you not consider that water not to be the Ottawa River? If it dries up, do you think that the Ottawa River disappeared? How much water is it necessary to be the Ottawa River, to continue to be the Ottawa River? All these questions are not... We see that it's just a convenient designation, for generally speaking, for a flow of water, none of which is really something, a noun, called the Ottawa River. It's all verbs. As long as we realize that when we talk to each other as well, and refer to each other, we're just talking about a general kind of process. We're using a noun, a name, or a pronoun, just for convenience sake, just to help us get around without... But we shouldn't take it too seriously. So our talk about each other as an identity, and our thinking about ourselves as an identity, is all right. It's a matter of practicality, but don't take it too literally and too seriously, because that's not what you are. You aren't a noun. There's just a bunch of flowing processes, which are, it's very different from a concrete identity. Identity is an interesting word. It means that it's one of the fundamental ways of thinking. In the West, it starts with Aristotle, principle of identity. What does he mean? He says something, what seems that rather obvious. He says, the foundations of all logical thinking is this. A is A. That's called the principle of identity. A thing is a thing and not something else. And that's the way we talk. But that sort of tends to permeate our thinking, but if we really, from a Buddhist point of view, A is not A. A isn't a thing to begin with. It's just a matter of convenience. So when we look at the world, it is not made of things. No thing is identical 2 moments in a row. What we're really looking at is not things, but flows or events. Verbal kind of actions are flowing. But there are no concrete, discrete things out there. And we aren't concrete, discrete things. We are verbs flowing. It's just that because we use nouns for names, we get confused. Presume that because you have the same name today, you are the same person that you were yesterday. But, of course, it's not that way. You're just using the same word. We do change our names from time to time. But if names were verbs rather than nouns, it would be more accurate and maybe would free our thinking up a little bit, because we are verbs. We aren't who we were yesterday. We aren't who we were 10 years ago. We won't be here tomorrow. You know, this moment won't be here. This thought won't be here. This feeling won't be here. Another thought will be here. Another feeling will be here. The thought from yesterday, where is it? Where is the feeling from yesterday? What is left of yesterday? What is left of you yesterday? It is just a convention of speech to say that is the same person that was here yesterday. You're not the same person who was here yesterday. He won't be here tomorrow. Somebody else will be here tomorrow. They may be using your name. In a sense, it's like your older sister will be here tomorrow. Your older brother will be here tomorrow. And you hope that you won't embarrass him. it's very interesting to look at our life that way. The college student who goes into debt and slaves away so that the 35-year-old can have a lot of money and a good job. The 35-year-old should be thanking that 18-year-old for putting them through, making that nice job and so forth, and putting up with all that. poor 18-year-old. Nothing comes back to the 18-year-old, does it? He's doing it for his older brother. So your younger brother, you can say, thanks a lot for putting up with all that poverty then, so I could, you know, have a nice job and money and so forth. Sometimes you have to pay off your younger brother's credit card spree. You ever had that experience? Foolish younger brother put me in debt. I have to pay off his credit card spree. So we have to, if we think, this is closer description. It sounds funny, but it is more a closer description of reality as it really is. Nouns are not descriptions. So, you know, say, exercise, what is your name as a verb versus a noun? I am not Sona, I'm Sona-ing. We are inging, you know, we're processing. We are Tomming, we are Dicking, we are Janing, we are Harrying, Billing, Bobbing. Billing and Bobbing. I think that should be the title of my second novel. Verbs, processes. It's very freeing. The crises and stresses and demands that come out of thinking in terms of nouns, that's where all our confusion, our identity, ownership, control, which I was talking about, comes out of the assumption that there is an owner. And an owner is a kind of a noun, a frozen thing in time, an identity, something that's identical 2 moments in a row. And when you investigate that way, there isn't. And that the problem itself is just an improper thought pattern. There isn't anybody with a problem. There's only a problem. Even such things as death. I mean, it's not, you're not going to die. Processes, there's just processes. Changes. It's a good idea. It tends to slip away, and that's why there's such a thing as a practice. And it's not something that if you read a book that you'll get it. It's not something even by listening to a talk that you'll get it. And there were people at the time of the Buddha that just walked out of a room like this and never had another problem in their life. And they were ripe for it. And that's, if the parami is there, if the work has been done somewhere along the line, one day the penny drops and enormous, you know, the iceberg slides into the sea and dissolves, melts. But don't be disappointed if it doesn't happen. Every time you tap on it, it's a stress fracture is happening there. And at some point, it all just slides away into the sea. So you keep allowing these kind of ideas to flow through the mind and keep practicing your meditation, keep reflecting on Dhamma. These are little stress fractures in the misconceptualization of self. Is that anything to do with your question? Yeah, okay, good. Okay. Yes.
Thank you very much.